get rid of that idea of the achievement mentality and to really be focused on the notion that Krishna's grace is, it's there. It's always there. And then now I'm looking more to see where is my resistance? So instead of trying to, do this and this and this to get the, to deserve the next sealed blob of mercy, no, it's already there, but obviously I'm resisting. So where is my resistance? And where can I begin to trust Krishna more? One thing, for me, like surrender means you kind of let go of things you don't need anymore. Because we've acquired so many things that let's get through this disconnected world that we're in. And so when we feel connected with Krishna, we can let go of things. It's a kind of a sweet surrender.
Conversation does not stop. Welcome back to the Free Radical Podcast, dear friends. Yet another episode of our ongoing dialogue with reality, trying to understand our place in the world and beyond it. So today I had the joy of engaging with a newly discovered friend and kindred spirit, in this case in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, Giri Govardhan Prabhu. Giri Govardhan first encountered Gaudiya Vaishnavism while studying at the University of Michigan in 1980. After a period of thoughtful reflection and prayer, he decided to move into the ISKCON Temple in Detroit, Michigan in 1992. Since then, he has also served at the temple in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and currently resides with his wife at the temple community in Potomac, Maryland. In recent years, like many practitioners, he has felt that his spiritual journey had reached a plateau. This sense of stagnation has prompted a deep personal inquiry into its underlying causes and possible remedies. He has come to believe that certain foundational misconceptions may be at the heart of the issue, and he is now actively engaged in a conscious effort to reboot his spiritual life with renewed clarity and purpose. So basically, there you have an introduction to the topics we will be talking about with Giri Govardhan Prabhu. What to do when we reach those blessed plateaus, how to deal with stagnation or so-called stagnation in a way that is free from shame and guilt in a toxic way, how to normalize things that many times we end up stigmatizing, and the need to reboot and the need to unlearn and the need to rediscover and to deconstruct misconceptions and how much they can really get in the way of a genuine spiritual experience. So welcome to the table. This is the Free Radical Podcast, and to support it, please subscribe to our channel by clicking on the bell. And if you feel inspired, nourished by our conversation, like it, share it, and drop your thoughts in the comments to keep the conversation for what it is. Again, an ongoing, endless dialogue with reality. So without further ado, dear brothers and sisters, here is Giri Govardhan. So Giri Govardhan Prabhu, thank you so much for joining us in the Free Radical Podcast today. Welcome.
Awesome. It's my pleasure.
Thanks so much. And usually I like to not only let my audience know how I met my guests, but also remind myself of those sweet, beautiful memories. And in this case, you are a recently discovered new friend, so to say, at least from my side, though you knew me a little bit more time for my online stuff. That's what happens to me a little bit. People know me for some time and I just trying to keep the pace when I met for them for the first time. So this happened with you a few weeks ago from where we are recording this podcast when I visited Washington, D.C. And we have a common friend, Diego. He told me, I asked him how you know him about me. And he told me there's another devotee, Giri Govardhan, who told me about you. So he recommended your lectures, and then Diego wanted both of us to meet. So we did that a few weeks ago in the Potomac Temple. And after a few minutes of sharing with Giri Govardhan Prabhu, I already knew, okay, I found another like-minded, like-hearted brother. And I invited him to the podcast very quickly to continue the conversations we already started that day. So it's my pleasure that he accepted the invitation. And let's start by asking you, Giri Govardhan Prabhu, I like to ask some of my guests as well, like what has brought you today to this arena of conversation with me today, apart from me extending the invitation to you, of course.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I discovered you through a recommendation from Rambaru.
Okay.
Devi Dasi, who she discovered you first, and then she was recommending your series and the YouTube series on radical personalism. And so when I started to listen to that, I was thinking, oh, this is exactly, you know, what I need and what is needed more in general. And I guess we began probably, you know, in the mid to late 1990s, of a few years after I had moved into the temple in Detroit, Michigan. And at about that time, there was a translation of the Madhurya Kadambini that was widely spread, and people were talking about it, and it was creating quite a buzz in ISKCON. And so when I got my copy, I was interested to see where I stood. And I got the kind of not so pleasant surprise that when I got just a few pages in and recognized myself very clearly. And so I also had contact from my spiritual master, who said that this kind of situation where devotees tended to get stagnated, reach a glass ceiling, was kind of typical, and has been typical, you know, throughout the history. And so I've been trying to break that glass ceiling for so many years. And so what I was hearing, some of the stuff I was hearing from you was resonating with things I had discovered and adding to that a lot. So I was interested in having more of your virtual association and now, you know, actual association.
Thank you for sharing. And I'm glad that you brought the topic of the Madhurya Kadambini and the descriptions of the various landscapes of the journey, so to say, or stages of the process, however we may like to articulate that. I always like to, and I appreciate that you address your spiritual master with some concerns in that regard. And from what I heard, he kind of normalized in one level also, like, okay, this is part of the journey, right? Like, let's gain some acceptance of some of these landscapes, not to remain there forever, but also not to crucify ourselves because of that. And that's something I always like to highlight. That for me was a highlight when I read Madhurya Kadambini first time, which was the longest part of the book, which is not that long in itself, but the longest part is about this section, the stage of called as Anartani Vritti, and how the author, Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur, unpacks all the different landscapes inside that landscape, so to say. And for me, it was a way of saying, okay, the more he unpacked that section, especially that related to Anishchita Bhajana Kriya or unstable bhakti, naturally, I will say most of the practitioners, at least 90-something percent, will raise their hand and like, that's me. Yeah. There are six main symptoms. That's me. Yeah. But somehow it's also a way of saying, that's me in the journey, right? Like those symptoms, as embarrassing as they are confirming that we are on the path, bhakti, the path back home, so to say. So instead of getting depressed or over-stigmatizing ourselves, we can see those symptoms as confirmations that we are on the journey. That's not the final place to stay, but it's a confirmation nonetheless. So that's one side. But of course, what you mentioned, and you described this briefly in your bio, and I would like to unpack some of those points with you. In your bio, you mentioned that, like many practitioners, and that's totally accurate, you felt at some point of your spiritual journey that you have reached a plateau, right? So I'm curious if you could describe a little bit more the moment and the period when you began to feel that your spiritual life had plateaued, if you will, and what did that realization feel like internally?
Yeah, I guess, well, that was actually the time when I read the Madhurya Kadambini. I was really, because I've been living in the temple. I was, you know, had good sadhana, and I was very enthusiastic. And I thought that at least, you know, I was, you know, to the level of steadiness. And then I realized, oh, well, that's not the case at all. I recognize myself very clearly. So I thought I need to address something here. You know, because it was some time. You know, I've been in there for some time, and so then I need to monitor this. I need to try to find out, you know, is there something I can adjust? One thing my spiritual master used to always quote Srila Prabhupada as saying that, you know, that bhakti was a science, and not like an empirical science, but like something that was well enough understood that you could take a look at it and say, okay, what's going wrong here?
Mm.
And so, you know, I tried the various things, and, you know, found myself still, you know, caught in that situation. And I think, you know, I was encouraged that somehow it could be remedied. But then as the years went by and it still wasn't remedied, somebody asked me this recently, like, you know, if we're not making progress, why do we go on? And I think I thought about it for a minute, and what came to me was that, you know, I had convinced myself that, you know, sooner or later, through the accumulation of the sadhana and service, that something would magically break through. You know, so I became a little bit less in touch with reality, and then as years went on after that, you know, then I'm thinking, well, maybe at the time of death, you know, you can cash in your chips and something is going to happen. You know, cash in chips, figuratively dying, but you could cash in your. And, you know, I think that was, you know, not looking at things realistically, but maybe I needed that extra optimism in order to carry on.
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, and I'm thinking, as you mentioned, of course, when you had this probably shocking realization of going through the different descriptions of Madhura Kadambini and realizing, oh, I'm actually here, I'm not where I thought I was, which can be a little bit like frustrating or discouraging, at least for the ego, or whatever idealized idea we had about ourselves. At the end of the days, so like I say, it's glorious to know where you are, no? Even if it's not in the highest place. In order to reach the highest place, you can only reach there from where you are. So establishing where we are, no matter how low or limited or whatever embarrassing that may be, in itself is crucial, and we cannot skip that point, no? And I'm reminded so many times in our tradition, our scriptures, this word adhikar, right? Like sveshva adhikari janishta, the Bhagavatam say, try to acknowledge your adhikar, where you are, up to what you can do. And that's real virtue. That's real beauty. Not as an excuse to remain there forever, but just as a very sober, honest assessment of the current situation. And from a realistic place, only after acknowledging that, you can be realistic about what's my next step to take from a realistic place to take the step, then the next step, right? I was laughing when you say about your idea, which is not only yours, of course, so many of us have had that at one point. Okay, bhakti is cumulative and quantitatively cumulative. Now, it may not have to be with qualitative cumulation, but quantitatively cumulative. So I'm having my 16 rounds box checked every day, my Mongol Arctic timing checked every day. So the numbers are legal, Krishna.
Yeah.
So as you say, even if I'm not feeling anything, somehow some magic will happen at the end of the weekend, at the end of the month, at the end of the year, at the end of the this lifetime at least.
Yeah,
exactly. And again, there's a place for that in some stage of the journey, but I appreciate that you at one point realized, I think something else needs to take place. Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking, Guru Govardhan Prabhu, regarding to the plateau, because sometimes I've heard this among practitioners. Okay, there may be natural phases of spiritual maturation, and you may feel that you're stagnated, and maybe you are not as stagnated as you may feel. This is also a thing for me that sometimes is tricky, because stagnation is quite related to the idea of progress, no? So I mean, related in the sense of one is seen as the opposite of the other. But many times we have a very, I will say, hyperbolic or over-romanticized idea of how progress should look like. So based on our over-idealized, over-romanticized idea of progress, if that's not happening, then we may conclude, I'm stagnated. Mm-hmm. While we may not be stagnated in some cases. You follow my point? So sometimes we may feel I'm not making progress because I'm not experiencing the ecstasy that Raghunath Das Goswami mentions in his scriptures, but that's not maybe supposed to happen yet. But that doesn't mean that I'm not making any progress either. So how in your own journey try to navigate those waters and being realistic, distinguishing between natural phases of spiritual maturation, actual stagnation? If you could share any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, once my initial enthusiasm was dashed a little bit, then I didn't think I had really terribly unrealistic objectives. I wasn't expecting to have, you know, Bhava or Brahma even Ruchi or Asakti, you know. Just how about just Nishta, you know? And of course when I discovered that that's really corresponds to the third verse of the Shikshastakam, then it's like that still is a pretty tall order. You know. Yeah. But in some ways, probably there was progress because I was looking and trying to find ways to see what was missing and how I could reorient myself. So even over the various, you know, years, there probably was some maturation happening, you know, but there was a glass ceiling between me and actually, you know, really coming close to at least deeply into Nishta. And so in that way, I just saw that there's something that still needs to be adjusted. You know, it's not just a matter of patience. There's some things else that need to be addressed and that sort of thing. So I've always been kept looking for, you know, what else could be done. And
You referred to this verse of Shikshastakam, third verse in connection to Nishta. For those who do not know, of course, Shikshastakam are these famous 8 instructions by Sri Chaitanya, and they have been, each verse has been somehow made a parallel with the 9 stages of bhakti, as they are described by Rupa Goswami, from Shraddha to Prem. Bhaktivinoda Thakur has been, to my knowledge, the first one who established that correlation. So the third verse, as you mentioned, famous verse, Trinada, Bisunichin, etc., is related to Nishta. And of course, as you say, when you go to that third verse, if you are honest, probably you won't say, oh yeah, I'm already there, let's go to the next one.
It's aspirational, not descriptive.
Exactly. It may not be too inspirational, because we may feel I'm too far from there, but hopefully it's aspirational. Yeah, it's inspirational in the context of becoming an aspiration to attain. But and in that connection, I remember in one of our private conversations, you also referred to the previous verse of Shikshastakam, because of course, if I'm not there in the third one, if I'm not there in Nishta, okay, let's rewind one verse back and let's go to the second one.
Exactly.
And let's see if I can find myself there, of course. And hopefully we can find ourselves there, because of course that's the verse which refers to these stages called Bhajana Kriya and Nartanivritti, you know, practice of devotional activities and in simultaneity with that, the cleansing or the getting rid of false values, so to say. And for me, something important in that, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, is that in this second verse of Shikshastakam, Sri Chaitanya, first, it has 4 lines. So the first 3 lines of that verse are a deep expression, I will say, of ecstatic gratefulness of Sri Chaitanya toward Krishna, toward the names of God. Nam Nama Kari Bahut, right? You have endless names. In all these names, there are endless potencies. Such is your mercy. It's like a deep, profound appreciation of the gift that is already coming. And then comes the last line, of course, Durdaiva Midrisham Iha Janina Anurag. And my misfortune is such that I still have no anurag, no attachment for that name. So there's some healthy acknowledgement and lamentation, but before the lamentation, and it's only 1 line, we have 3 thick lines of gratitude and appreciation, which I really always appreciated that proportion and that order. It's not like first 3 lines of self-deprecation and then 1 line of appreciation. No, first appreciation of the gift, undeserved grace. And in that context of positive gratitude, okay, acknowledging where I am. So any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that was one, the approach I was taking too, was with the Shastra, seeing that there has to be something here that really moves the needle. And you described it perfectly. I mean, because oftentimes, you know, the acharyas say that the durdaivam, I'm so unfortunate that I don't have anuraga, and they'll talk about the offenses, you know, against the chanting. But I really think because there's the kind of root offense of pramada, you know, which is almost the same thing as the anuraga, You know, because if you're interested in something, you're attentive. If you're truly interested, interest, I think attentiveness correlates very closely with interest.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way I saw it was that the first three lines you're expressing that you understand that there's so much to be grateful for.
Mm.
I mean, in one sense, it's interesting. You know, Krishna's first move with us is to say, "Here, you don't know me, but here, take me."
Mm-hmm.
If the holy name is Him, here, take me. And but yet somehow that gratitude isn't sinking in. Mm-hmm. And I think if I remember correctly, in the Madhurya Kadambini, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur talks about the hard-heartedness.
Mm-hmm.
He quotes the verse from the second canto where the heart is like, it's ashmasaram, it's like stone.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
Of course, that continues all the way up into Baba, because in that verse it talks about if you don't have the astasapika babas, then you're hard. But here it's gets softer as you move towards that. So it's very mm-hmm. hard here. So even mm-hmm. though you can intellectually appreciate that there's some great gift given, somehow it's not sinking into the heart.
Mm. So I'm hearing that, and I'm, of course, naturally the next question that comes is, okay, I'm not in Baba, we are not in Baba, most of us are not in the hyper-melted stage of the heart, but still, how can we practice bhakti, how can we engage in a relationship with the divine in some way, whatever we are, in a way that starts to melt something, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it's okay, I'm practicing now, I don't feel anything, everything is mechanical, formulaic. At one point, suddenly everything starts to melt. No, something needs to melt now. And I'm thinking, in connection to this verse of Sikshastaka, in connection to this acknowledgement and gratitude for the gifts that are coming and how those gifts are unearned, right? And I'm recalling, I think, in one of our interactions, you mentioned something that there is a difference between bhakti as reciprocation and bhakti as supplication, right? So can we explore that? What happens when we approach Krishna thinking that we have to earn His love, right?
Yeah.
Like the goal of life is love from Krishna instead of love for Krishna, instead of returning the embrace that has already been thrown upon us.
Yeah, and that I think that's really the issue there, because I think it's been common. I mean, I'll tell you in this kind anyway, even from the earliest days, there was a phenomenon that people talked about where when you first began, and of course there's a natural enthusiasm when you begin any new project, but it was something beyond that, where people would really feel something from being in contact with Krishna, and a real enthusiasm that would kind of wane. And the unfortunate understanding that kind of cropped up, and it's still around today in some places, is that Krishna gives you this, comes out and gives you this kind of love bomb too. If I want to put it in kind of a pejorative way, love bombs, gives you this little taste of Krishna consciousness, then He withdraws it, and then you have to earn it.
Mm.
And so the very unfortunate remedy there, because it's not earnable.
Mm-hmm.
And His mercy is, I guess what happened to me was my spiritual master, he started to talk in more recent years, he talked about how the relationship is only broken on our side, not mm-hmm. from Krishna's side. And so when we think we have to earn Krishna's love, we're projecting that it's broken from His side and we have mm-hmm. to mend it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said that the normal path in whatever we do here in this world is the path of achievement and getting bigger and stronger. And ours is he calls it the bigness of littleness. Ours is getting less. Mm-hmm. And so it's really the willingness to accept the mercy. I think that's a real issue. And so that's a paradigm shift that makes everything different.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I think I intellectually grasp it, I have been trained and been the opposite way for so many years that I have to keep not slipping back into the same idea.
Mm.
And so when we think that we act, and then if we act sufficiently, Krishna will respond with some mercy. That's not a very pleasant feeling.
Mm.
But where we feel that Krishna is simply mercy, So I found that passage in the book by Richard Rohr, who I thought really said it very nicely, where he said in his earlier years he thought that God's mercy was something that would happen even maybe a little grudgingly, he said, and at certain specific moments. And then mm-hmm. he said that as he grew older, he understood that that's who God was.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was really our job to sink deeper and deeper and deeper into the net of mercy, and how that we're resistant to that. And he gave mm-hmm. a couple of examples. He said, we may think that we're not good enough,
mm-hmm.
that how could God love us, in our current condition? And then the other things, we might think we're better than that.
Superiority conflicts or inferiority conflicts.
I want the credit. I want the credit. And so that blocks it.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me pretty clearly that the effort that we're supposed to make, the work that we're supposed to put in, is of the kind that allows us to be more open to that mercy. We're resistant, actually. It's mm-hmm. not that it's not available or it's difficult to get. The problem is on our side being willing to even believe it and willing to let it happen in our lives.
Yeah. Because I remember, as I like to think, is, if we speak about unconditional mercy or irreversible grace, as I like to call it, it may sound too good to be true, especially for some of us who may be cynical or have gone through some situation of not much experience of unconditional love. To hear about that may sound like, no, that's not possible. The only way to get it is to earn it, and not like something freely given. And as you say, it requires a paradigm shift to really enter that space, and it makes the whole difference when we engage in our life and practice from a place that, no, this is love, is God's grace is too much to be earned. I cannot even use the word of earning. As you say, it's unearnable. So, and it requires so much humility then, because as you say, for the false self, for the false ego, it's too much to receive a gift that I have not anything to deserve it. And no matter what I do, I will never deserve it. It's a blast to the ego. So that's a price to pay for getting a costless mercy. As I like to say, it's costless, but it's not priceless. In the sense that we have to pay a price not to receive it, but to experience it. And the price is to be humble enough to acknowledge this is coming despite my imperfection, my brokenness, or as you say, the other side, this is coming despite my efforts to deserve and to merit and to be perfect. All this has nothing to do with the nature of this gift. So I really appreciated how you mentioned this point of in the beginning, devotees may experience some initial enthusiasm and then that's gone. And the word enthusiasm comes from the Latin in theos, right? To have God within, or the capacity to experience God's presence inside of us. So I'm thinking, putting all the things together, I'm thinking real enthusiasm, real God within is to remain aware, to have the discipline to remain aware of how God's grace keeps coming. Because as you say, quoting Richard Rohr, mercy is not what God has, but who God is, right? So he cannot not be that. Now, if Krishna will stop being Karuna Sindhu, an ocean of mercy, he will stop being Krishna. And that's an impossibility, an ontological absurd. God cannot stop being who he is. So, grace and mercy is not a quality that God possesses, an attribute, but it represents the divine's very essence and constitution. So I think that in itself, we need to stay enough time with that idea and unlearn all the other patterns that get in the way of that idea. And that's, for me, it's anartha nibriti also. I like to think anartha nibriti not so much as only, I don't know, as we were saying, I fulfill my daily quota of rounds, and as an automatic byproduct, anartha nibriti, I'm free from all bad stuff. But no, also, I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but not just by getting a number, but by doing it with quality. But also, anartha nibriti for me, it's an intentional type of discernment, an intentional engagement with the practice, an intentional unlearning, deconstructing false values. That was anartha nivritti means. Anartha means false value. Artha means value. Anartha means false value. Nivritti means get rid of false values of misconceptions, right? Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say one of the first anarthas will be tattvabhi brahma, or to be bewildered about reality, about what it was, what is what. So, and you refer in your bio also to you discover some fundamental misconceptions at the heart of your spiritual struggle. Probably one of these being the idea of, okay, God's love had to be earned. But I don't know if you will be willing to share another one of those fundamental misconceptions.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there are some other, corollaries to the notion of achievement. Yeah. I think the actual explanation where people had the genuine initial enthusiasm and that wanes, it comes in the first characteristic of Anishtha Sadhana Bhakti, the Utsahamayi. That one, first of all, when one comes in contact with it, you understand it's a gift in some way. You never knew such a thing could exist, and you're naturally humble. And then as you're moving along, you start to want to take the credit. Think, oh, I'm really moving along. I'm doing it. I'm somehow pushing it forward. So there's some of that initial enthusiasm turns into feeling good about yourself in a not necessarily a super healthy way. Mm. And so then you're turning away from the grace at that point. And yeah. So the other thing that happens when you have that mentality that you can achieve it, then you have a tendency to look externally. And I think part of the thing that happened at least in the Hare Krishna movement was that in the beginning, it was, in fact, in the first 20 years, it was really largely monastic style. So people would come in and they would, you know, kind of precipitously change all of their behaviors. The way they dress, the way they eat, the way they sleep, the way they, everything. And so it's you conflate that with what it means to be Krishna conscious. So it's a behavioral. You acquire all of these different new devotional qualities. And so you have a situation where you're becoming a devotee from the outside in, rather from the inside out. You're actually creating a persona, an artificial persona, which is riding above, you know, your real thing. And the quantitative sort of notion also tends to begin to ignore the internal component of bhakti, like Srila Prabhupada would translate bhakti as devotional service. And I notice many times we shorten it just to service. And we think that, and there's internal components in that.
We reduce service to doing stuff only.
Yeah, doing stuff, you know, hopefully for the pleasure of Krishna. But in Rupa Goswami's, you know, definition of the ultimate bhakti, you know, there's motivation. That's an internal component. Mm-hmm. There's your level of trust or faith. How much can bhakti do? And that's the second line. And then there's what do you feel about Krishna? And that the anukulya, and Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says in the Bhadra Academy that anukulya is the very life of the bhakti creeper.
Hmm.
And so I think when you're trying to become Krishna conscious from the outside in, in one sense, you're becoming disconnected from your internal self.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, you're not even inclined to be very introspective and think so much about. And plus, you're being told what you're supposed to feel about those things. You're told what your motive is supposed to be. You're told what you're supposed to feel. And you're told you're supposed to have so much faith. And so you're not really, like in any other human relationship, if I ask you, I can ask you about somebody, you'll know what you desire from that relationship. It's automatic, your motivation. What do you expect to get? What can you expect from that person, your trust and faith? And what do you feel about them? You automatically know that.
Mm-hmm.
But many times, I think, I mean, as devotees, we don't know those things. Why am I really doing it? What is my level of faith and trust? And then what do I really feel? Because I'm supposed to be something else. And so that cuts off that internal part, and it becomes just an external action, you know, to a large degree. I think that's a very harmful thing, that the achievement mentality happens forces you to do. And then naturally, there was the temple president here some years ago gave me a book by Parker Palmer, who participated in Quakerism for a long time, and he has a book called Hidden Wholeness. So he talks about how, you know, the pressures of society oftentimes cause us to disengage from our real self and have kind of an artificial self. He makes this a divided self.
Mm-hmm.
And he says when that happens, he says even you can forget who that is if it's too much. And that also causes, you know, to be separated from your natural enthusiasm for life.
Mm.
And so if we take bhakti from the outside in,
mm-hmm.
we become, you know, then that's another reason why we lose the enthusiasm, because it's not genuine. And if we're going to try to ascertain and try to see what is it, because really the question is not so much how can I achieve Krishna's mercy, because that's there, but what is it that's blocking it? Why am I blocking it? How am I blocking it? I don't want to accept it. You know, it might be for the ego things, but also just I'm afraid. Do I want to relinquish control over my life?
Mm-hmm.
What's Krishna going to do? Can I trust him to come in and start, you know, moving the furniture around?
And there are so many questions that start when you start to do that moving of the furniture, when you start to do that inquiring, like, okay, what's getting in the way, as you say, right? That's such an important, crucial question, instead of becoming cynical or judging God, or there's some conspiracy going on outside of me, against me, I'm the victim. No, I know that God's irreversible grace is coming to me. I'm not experiencing that. What's getting in the way? Without entering into a toxic guilt, shame trip, but just taking responsibility only in your own journey. And again, as you say, so many questions and so many answers to the questions come. What's getting in the way? Maybe I'm afraid. Why I'm afraid? Because I have this idea of God, of Krishna, that he may chastise me, or this or that, or and why do I have that idea? Maybe that's related with the previous authority figure in my life. Many times I end up realizing I have this unresolved childhood trauma, which I'm still carrying that unsolved wound, and I'm filtering reality through that and projecting that even to God. And again, all that is messy in one sense. It's a messy journey, and a necessary one in most cases. And I think it's important that, as you mentioned, we give practitioners, and of course this is not about ISKCON, this is not about even Hare Krishna movement, Gaudiya Vaishnavism, this is going on everywhere. I'm connected with people from various traditions, and this is human condition, let's put it that way. So just to normalize the experience and make it more global and collective, so we do not over isolate and think it's only me going through that, because that makes the whole thing 10 times worse. So, but I totally agree with you how many times with the honeymoon period of spirituality ends, like it happens in the world. You get married, you have your honeymoon, and then you are grounded, invited to another level of reality and commitment. But how to keep the honeymoon going in one sense, but at the same time doing the necessary. But unfortunately, as you mentioned, sometimes we end up entering into this achievement mentality and adopting a persona, which I'm not against the notion of persona, which actually means a mask through which one sound. We need some sense of self to interact with the world, though that may not be our eternal identity. So as long as we do not fully identify with that mask, that role, so to say, that position we may need to take on a daily basis. And sometimes, that whole persona, that whole mask ends up devouring who we actually are, and we end up being performative more than transformative, right? Or to make a play of words, and spirituality ends up being more transactional than transformational, or more, in Richard Rohr's words, more about correctedness instead of connectedness, right? So many words to use to say the same thing. So I really appreciate your emphasis on the anukul, this word in Sanskrit that means favorable, or favorability, or basically intentionality, right? To engage in bhakti. For me, bhakti is just quote unquote developing my loving relationship with the divine, But that includes everything and everyone at the same time, right? I like to be inclusive when we say Krishna or God. And that's interestingly what Jiva Goswami says when he comments on this definition of Uttam Bhakti that you referred to, given by Rupa Goswami. And he says, the definition by Rupa Goswami is, a Krishna is the object of bhakti. And Jiva Goswami says, yes, but if we understand Krishna as exclusive, in an exclusivistic way, excluding everyone else, that's a narrow-minded understanding. So a broader understanding is Krishna plus whatever exists in relationship to Krishna. And of course, then the question is, so what's in relationship to Krishna? Everything. So how to relate to everything with anukulyana, no? with favorability, with a proper intention. And at the end of the day, as simple as that sounds, Krishna is taking into consideration our intention. I'm not saying this as an excuse to not make an effort for this or that. No, it's all the intention. In one sense, it's very challenging to hear that. In one sense, it's a relief because, oh, Krishna is not stuck in externals. He's not concerned about the outer perfection of the offering, but the intention. But then the question is, so what's my intention? So what's really going on in my heart? Do I have an intention? Do I have some favorable investment in what I'm doing or not? So that's a deep invitation for, again, for moving the furniture, for asking this question, for being introspective. Like, I don't know. I like always to think, for example, in our tradition, one word for the study of sacred scriptures is swadhyaya. But swadhyaya means swa in our own self, dhyaya, to contemplate. So the idea to meditate on yourself. So the idea is, but it's translated as studying the sacred scripture. So the point is, you go to a sacred book, and that has to take you to inner introspection and discernment. And what do I need to do? How this applies to me? Where I am here? How that's speaking to me? Again, radical personalism is about people, individuals, right? And I like to say also, one, the very first word that according to the Bhagavatam sounds in creation that Brahma hears is tapas. And one word for tapas is fire. And means introspection. Close your eyes and see. Enter into the inner fire. That's what Brahma does. He hears fire and he doesn't take two branches and starts to make fire. He closes his eyes and becomes introspective. And that's like entering into a fire. So I think it's so important that we kind of not institutionalize, but normalize this type of aspects as crucial elements of the journey, right?
Yeah, I think that's really important. I think something that's hurting people a lot is that people generally do not talk about this. In one sense, everybody knows, you know, that this is a problem. But because it's not talked openly enough, then people have a tendency that maybe it's only me. Right? People are posting on Facebook, they had this beautiful kirtan, they went to this beautiful place, they had this wonderful lecture, and everybody's happy, and it must be only, is it only me? And then when that happens, you know, then you know, you there's a certain psychology when you feel that you're a particular failure. You know, if you're going through just a fairly normal circumstance, it may not be so pleasant, but it's a normal circumstance, that's okay. But when you think maybe you're a special failure, then there's a real psychological pressure to try to address that in some way. And so you may try to find fault with others to make sure that, hey, I'm not alone. You may try to, you know, find something that's distinctive about you that you're really good at and hang your hat on that. You may try to gain a high profile in some other way. You may substitute, you know, worshiping your guru for substitute that for spirit, trying to actually make spiritual advancement yourself. It's like a submergence. And there's various other kind of things that have secondary things that can happen. So now you have the initial problem that you have, and now you've got these secondary problems that you've built on top of it. And so, you know, when there's too much silence about it, then I think it's really hurtful for people.
Thank you for making that point. Yeah, I told it many times, and I will tell it one more time now because it's never enough. But in my travels around the world and meeting so many people throughout the year, so many members of our tradition from different affiliations. And I will say one of the main things that I hear in terms of, not complaint, but in terms of necessity, is this point, like, they would come to me and tell me, Maharaj, we don't have a space to share. So to say, there is no like crafted space to share our concerns, to share our feelings, to share our journey sometimes. And without complaining about the classical structure of the Vaishnav program, so to say, no? But they will say, okay, there is kirtan, there is the arti, there is the class, there is the prasad, there is some social interaction. How are you? Everything fine. See you next Sunday. But we don't have that space. And of course, what I told them is, you don't need to wait for someone to inaugurate that space, but necessity is the mother of invention. So it makes sense that you feel a need, as you say, to talk about things, as simple as that sounds. If we don't create space, if we don't make time to share our hearts, again, what Rupa Goswami will call revealing your mind in confidence, basically, right? Guhyam akyati prichati, to share your heart vulnerably, honestly, with another like-minded spirit. I mean, that's so crucial. And when that's not going on, that for me is a form of Shravan and Kirtan, right? Like listening and talking about Krishna. It's not just Kirtan is picking a mridang or giving a class, and Shravan is sitting, hearing someone giving the class, but also giving and receiving our hearts in the context of common center that is God. That's also a form of Shravan and Kirtan. And we need to be received, to be listened. We need to speak. We need to feel, okay, I have permission to speak. I can speak. I have my own voice. You have to discover. That's not like a toxic independence, so to say, no, that you cannot speak for yourself. You cannot think. I can understand at some point in the very beginning, we may be a little cautioned about, be careful of not just developing your own sampradaya in your mind and your own ideas and philosophy if you are not properly rooted. But at some point, you need to exercise your wings, so to say, and to fly your own sky and to sing your own song as a bird, so to say. So, yeah, I totally agree with you about the need for just normalizing some certain conversations so the topic becomes so normalized that people do not feel excluded any longer. Because many times this, as you say, feeling of isolation just happens because nobody's talking about those things that most of us are going through.
Yes.
And the very moment someone speaks, oh, that creates empathy and connection because, oh, I'm also going through that. And I'm also going, and I'm hearing your testimony, and that's mirroring back my own journey. So that creates bonds, creates community, actually, creates a sense of belonging. All the things that we want to steal into the members of the community, and many times they happen mostly by allowing them to share, even sometimes to share their fears, their doubts, their necessities, their anger.
They have to be able to say that. They have to. Oh, they have to say that, you know.
It's not only, okay, so of course there is place for gratitude and appreciation and praise and all glories ki jai. But also, as you say, we need to create safe vessels in which people can feel safe enough to show their fears and disconformities and doubts and anger and grieving and sadness, and all that can happen in the sacred vessel. So I'm thinking, if someone listening now is going through a similar chapter or a similar plateau or feeling stagnated or feeling, what will you want to say to them, Gir Govardhan Prabhu? Not as advice, as telling them what to do, but as solidarity. Solidarity.
Yeah, again, what you're going through is you know, is utterly normal, and it doesn't mean you're a failure in any measure. You know, and there's, you know, so many of us who are there walking with you, but I do think there are these kind of fundamental things that we've gotten wrong in many places, and including the achievement mentality that's really exacerbating that. I have a little group I have on Sundays, and somebody, you know, shared that they're afraid that Krishna, if they surrender to Krishna too much, he's going to ruin their life, because you see it sometimes in the scriptures, you know. And actually, I had somebody else who had a group of people, and that was one of the big fears that people had, was that they're afraid of what Krishna may do if they surrender to him, you know. And if they keep that inside, and they think, oh, what kind of a person am I? When they realize it's happening with other people, you know, then okay, you can take a deep breath and say, okay, now, you know, let's examine that.
Yeah.
Let's work with that.
Yeah.
You know. And it just makes so much difference. And to find other people. I mean, rightfully we emphasize that you hear from, you know, persons who are more knowledgeable in this than yourself. So we have that. You know, somebody sits in the Vyasasana and speaks, and also we share with others. But that peer association, where you really can understand each other very well, that seems to be. Oh, that's kind of a waste of time. What are we going to do that for? We should be doing some service. We should be doing this. We should be doing that. People think that's selfish, and it's really it's not. it's not at all.
Totally
agree. And you get to, you know, Henry Nouwen. He wrote this book called The Wounded Healer.
Yes.
And one of the things he says in there is he said, for a compassionate person, nothing human is alien.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so if we can listen to one another, you know, in that frame of mind, you know, and that's, you know, of course we understand that that everybody is dear to Krishna, and that's one. But to me, like when you said, you know, the love for Krishna, you know, it has to expand to everything. For myself, at least, I find that it's easier to have it be in, it happens, it increases in discrete moments. Mm-hmm. A little bit more understanding of this person at this time, a little bit more understanding here. Because if I try to have a global perspective, usually what happens is then I Krishna will send me the person I have the most difficulty with. And I'm blown all, okay, go back for the chant a few more rounds and come back with my global perspective, how I love everybody. And then boom, little pin blows my little purse, my bubble. So that's okay, somehow, even just a little bit at a time, and with individual moments. Try to let that flow a little bit. Okay, you know.
Yeah, I'm being very intentional in those little moments, right? Instead of again, achievement mentality, grandiose. I have to just make this ultra mega big stuff, and we lose sight of the uniqueness of each moment in the present moment. I always recall of Saint Teresa of Lisieux, this Christian saint, and she will have this method called the little way. Right. And for her, it will be just the little way, like giving herself to God in every moment, in small situations, offering a flower, peeling a potato, again, glancing at someone, but doing that with as much intentionality as I can, which is much presence and giving of myself. You know? How much can I give myself in glancing at this person in the street now, or in hearing to my brother in this situation, or in whatever, maybe cleaning the bathroom, whatever. I don't have to wait for Sunday feast or for being appointed in this position or for being this or that, for giving myself as much as I can, right? So I really like that notion of little way, because it's also very humbling and very self-protective, in the sense that I can be protected by behaving in such a way and being realistic and trying to, yeah.
It opens those pathways. You know, you have the understanding in the head, but then it opens the pathways. And once you start opening the pathways, it flows more easily each time.
In connection, Gir Govardhan Prabhu, to the rebooting that you were referring to, you shared with me a few days ago when we were having an interaction, a short excerpt from your Gurudev, Rabindra Swarup Prabhu, around which you feel inspired to share some thoughts. So if you give me permission, I have it with me here.
Yeah, please.
I will read it. There's a few lines. This comes from a paper called The Pillars of Success, which again is related mostly to ISKCON, but of course, as I say, it's applicable to any organized religious group. And you just have to replace the specific lingo from each group, and there you have it. These are patterns of universal application. So I'll read it briefly, and I would like to hear some of your thoughts. He says, the point is that the difficulties that precipitated the guru reform movement are intimately connected with psychological patterns and styles of relationships that began to establish themselves from the beginning. These are grounded in the inability of many devotees to acknowledge and deal fruitfully with their own spiritual shortcomings and failures, or in traditional vocabulary, their inability to execute the process of anartha nivritti, the eradication of unwanted things from the heart. This general widespread failure, which pervades the institution and has even shaped some structural features of it, is the root debility of which the guru crisis, the crisis of succession, is simply a highly visible symptom. It is my conviction that any real reform has to address effectively the root debility. Too many of us have tried to fix the symptom while ignoring the local manifestation of the disease, including the manifestation within our own hearts. Too many have tried to purify ISKCON as a substitute for purifying ourselves. This kind of behavior is the disease, not the cure. Amen.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for sharing that sermon with us. And yeah, it reminds me of, I'd like to hear your thoughts. It just reminds me of famous Albert Einstein's famous words that if I have 60 minutes to solve a problem, I will spend 55 minutes trying to understand which is the actual problem and then 5 minutes solving it. But first get the problem right instead of addressing the symptom of the problem, as your Gurudev is saying here. So please feel free to share any initial thoughts on the above words from your Gurudev.
I mean, because it was this paper, that paper was for ISKCON Communications Journal about an insight he'd had previously. There was this situation where there was, you know, issues with the structure of gurus in ISKCON, and he was supposed to write a paper about that. And when he went back from a meeting back to his temple in Philadelphia, he said he had to pray. He needed some guidance from the Super Soul, so he prayed. And instead of something about gurus coming out, he said came rushing out of him his understanding of what was the deeper issue with our society, and he kind of expressed that here. So what was interesting is that, you know, the individual problems we have, of course, they affect us individually, but then he said particularly then it when people are in that condition, and especially if we don't address it and we don't acknowledge it, and we're feeling guilty about it, we're feeling shameful about it, and we're doing other things to compensate for it, we withdraw from each other because we feel shame. Therefore, instead of coming together, we withdraw. We compete against each other because we think if we, you know, maybe rise up the corporate ladder, that validates us, even though we know internally we don't, we know better. But other people think I'm great. And so there's competition. There's no chance to help each other. He said people talk about each other, but nobody helps.
Yeah.
And so he said that when you have that kind of situation, you know, you can't have any kind of caring relationships because everybody's kind of suffering in silence. And so it causes, the interpersonal stuff causes organizational difficulties. And he had this kind of vision. He said that if that could happen, if we could do a much better job about that, then he says, you know, you have these, you know, much more loving relationships that become so attractive to people. And so he said that if that happened, then Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement would be, he said, no force on earth could stop it. Mm-hmm. I like to think myself, if we had the kind of connections that we really aspire to and could have, we wouldn't have to convince people even so much about the teachings of the philosophy. I joke that we could be devil worshippers and people would think about it. I don't know, devil worshippers. It's so nice here. Let me do it, you know. And almost in spite of the philosophy.
On the other side, no matter how charming your idea of God is, if you are not representing that in how you relate to each other, that's not the all attractive Krishna. Sorry.
Yeah, it's not, you know. So yeah. So it's, yeah, so to me, it's like this, it's exciting in the fact that, you know, there's hope for me individually, you know, but I think if more and more people, you know, can kind of reverse some of these foundational things about, you know, the achievement mentality and the fact that Krishna, that the relationship is broken from Krishna's side and we have to mend that and all these kinds of things, mm-hmm. that then, you know, everything becomes, I mean, it'll be so much easier. And then when there's people who are doing that, becoming healthier, they're such better association for others.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be much easier for those. I mean, when I try to talk to people about this stuff, I'll tell them, you know, I've been kind of doing it wrong for so many years that it's hard for me to do it. But if you can understand this now in kind of the fairly early stages, I'm probably going to watch you go zooming right past me. And if you do, please remember me and give me your association after you've done so.
Yeah. Well, thank you there so much there. I always love to think of relationships as a service. Again, Prabhupada translate bhakti as devotional service, and to relate to one another lovingly is in itself devotional service. Again, it's not that it's something else. To develop and not to relate, just not to be nice, to have a nice face for the Sunday feast, like to put a mask, but to develop the relationships for the pleasure of Guru, for the pleasure of Krishna, for the pleasure of one another, is in itself one of the most important services. Not only is service, is one of the most important service we can offer to Krishna for his pleasure. It's because in one sense, as you say, it's easier, before you say, it's easier to worship the Guru, to make a very external show of worship, to avoid something deeper, to avoid the inner substance of following the example. Not like, I don't know, in Christianity, Jesus will never, he never say worship me, he always say follow me. But that's more difficult. It's easier to worship him. So we may end up doing the same with the Guru. Worship the Guru, but real worship is follow the Guru, right? So in the same way, trying to impress God with some outer stuff instead of offering my daily relationships. No, as service, again, as offering, as a part of offering myself, basically. And as you say, I will say, if we are, the more we live from that space, we don't need to convince anyone about anything. And I will say that the very idea, the very, how to say, if some of us still think in terms of I have to convince that person, first started with I have, and then follow with convince, that in itself speaks there is something wrong going there. Because if what I'm doing is so beautiful, so charming, so naturally attractive, there's no need to convince anything of everyone. It's just there's a need of people of being witness, bearing witness to that, and just being enchanted by that. So convincing means I'm trying to sell you something for what is not, so to say. Like in publicity, for me, that sounds like they're convincing us to buy a product, but actually what they are selling us is not the actual product. So, but if what we are selling, quote unquote, we are not selling, but what we are offering is not a product or not a lie, but the ultimate truth, there is no need to convince. It's just a need to present it as purely as possible and transparently as possible. But that doesn't mean just be philosophically accurate or externally impeccable, but what's the quality of your, again, of your relationships? And when we have that in place, everything follows naturally. For me, the notion of sambandha is so crucial in that regard, right? Sambandha actually means everything is related. Sambandha, bandha means connected, bonded, and sam means everything. So when I really walk my talk, everything is connected with the common center, and I orient my understanding and my practice through that principle, avideya, or the practice, follows naturally in a healthy way. Yeah. And the fruit will come, of course, naturally as well. But it all begins with sambandha, with having the proper orientation. Who am I? Who is Krishna? Who is everyone else? What's the nature of our connection, interconnection, interrelatedness? When we have a healthy, wholesome, realistic orientation to all that, then naturally I will choose to live my life from a certain place in a certain way that will be all attractive, will represent the all attractive we are worshiping. And as you say, if that's not there, we have all these complicated systems built upon fear, upon shame. We have all this systemic evils, if we want to call it, or corruption in the groups and institutions. And not to blame, not to demonize anyone, just like understanding them with compassion, actually, but with objectivity. Okay, this is going on. Like, I appreciate your Gurudev is doing, critiquing your own tradition, not as an outsider throwing rocks and leaving the tradition as a cynic, but remaining in the tradition, loyal to it, and because I love this tradition, I dare to criticize it with commitment, increasing my loyalty by the critique itself. So, yeah, I think we need many of those voices more and more. I was recently reading this late book by Richard Rohr, and it's called The Tears of Things. And he speaks a lot about the Hebrew prophets, and in brief, he speaks a lot about prophets, and prophets as people who have a voice and have a vision to see what's actually going on in their own religion, in their own tradition. And they are trained and protected to offer insight, to offer feedback, or we will call it healthy criticism, for the tradition. So the tradition remains sober, so to say, does not remain blind to its own shortcomings and becomes a cult many times. So, yeah, big need for that.
Yeah, he was saying how, you know, that kind of a change can be done at the grassroots level. You know, like you said, you can find people, find that association, try to do that, try to make connections like that. And it doesn't have to come from the top down. He was part of the upper management. And so he would say it doesn't have to come from that publicly. Yeah. And then privately, he would say, thank God it doesn't have to come from the upper levels. That we can do something, we can start today.
Exactly. That's the same what I say to these devotees who told me, we feel the need to have spaces to share. And it's like, hey, don't wait for receiving a permission from someone else to do so. Just do it.
Precisely.
That
third verse of the Shikshaskam, you know, the way as I understand it anyway, it gets progressively deeper and more difficult. It's a deeper challenge, right? Because the last one is the relationships with others. Third one, you know, because we usually get our self-esteem from comparison with others.
Yeah.
And so if we can feel sufficiently loved by Krishna, then we're secure. We don't need validation. And then also we easily can see others as being loved by Krishna. And so those relationships become assumed, you know.
Yeah.
I see the other parts. I see, like, you know, the humility part is where we're open then to Krishna's grace. And then the tolerance, I mean, this is kind of my own way of looking at it, but that when we give permission for Krishna to give us grace, sometimes he's going to lead us in places that we hadn't intended for him to take us. Because love means you want the welfare of the other. So he gives us what we need, not necessarily always what we want. And so we may have to confront things that we don't. I always think that the Gita is like this, you know, the situation with Arjuna. That's the last thing Arjuna could have imagined happening. And Krishna gives him that thing that just disintegrates him. You know, and then he has to reintegrate later on, you know. So some ways, you know, Krishna may lead us into places that are fearful to us and challenging for us for our own good. So there's a tolerance that has to come there, and a deepening of trust with Krishna. The trust is deepening. There's initial trust and it deepens. And then we finally feel so secure with Krishna that it's easy to even, you know, to really do it beautifully with others. So again, just to piggyback on your, you know, saying the importance of relationships, you know, that's really where it comes.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and for me also, that third verse of the Shikshastakam is kind of our golden rule. Like, every religion has their golden rule, treat others as you would like to be treated, and so on. This is very much about that. It's about relationships, and that's why it's so challenging, that third verse. Because many times we are a mess in relationships, and that verse comes to put us in our place, so to say, to really, if we are honest, you can always go to that third verse of Shikshastakam and see where you are and grow from that, right? And I really appreciate what you mentioned, because that I've gone to that place as well, how to read the third verse through the lenses of Krishna's unconditional love. Because sometimes this third verse can be also weaponized and used for demanding submission in a toxic way and tolerate abuse and force respect when it's not the place for that. So how to reframe that verse from a place of, if I see that you are loved by Krishna I'm drawn to honor that, to respect that. If I'm loved by Krishna, I won't look for any other form of honor because I'm already receiving the highest form of honor from the most important person. And again, if I'm loved by God, it's so humbling, or I can be tolerant from so many places as he's tolerating me through his unconditional love. So again, it's a whole paradigm shift. It's a change of a perspective that really makes the difference. Yeah, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, we've weaponized those two things, humility and surrender, right? Number one, you are nobody, and therefore you need to obey. Do what you're told. Because you're nobody, you must do what you're told.
Yeah.
And, oh, my God.
Yeah, and I personally like to very quickly reframe or redefine those two, like humility. As Mahaprabhu gives the example in that verse, Trinada Pisunichena, be as humble as the blade of grass. And I like to think, okay, the blade of grass is bending without breaking. So learn to bend in a way that is not breaking you, but is dignifying to you. So that's the humility we want. And surrender is like Richard Rohr once will say, we should surrender out of awe and wonder, not out of fear, out of pressure, out of intimidation, out of social fitting in. But I'm in front of something so awesome and wonderful, I cannot but feel drawn to give myself to that. That's actually how Jiva Goswami defines the notion of Krishna, of Bhagavan, as the all-attractive. He will say, Bhajaniya Guna Vishishta. He has such qualities that you feel irresistibly called to surrender to him. It's irresistible. It has to happen from that place, not by force, not by imposition. So yeah. There's a lot of rebooting to do. And in connection to that, as we are wrapping up, Giri Govardhan Prabhu, you spoke, of course, also in your bio about rebooting your spiritual life. What does a reboot of spiritual life mean for you at this stage of your journey today?
Yeah.
It's about returning to basics, but in a deeper way, embracing a new paradigm, both of them, or something else entirely?
Yeah, it's mostly, you know, embracing that paradigm. I guess, and the things that are connected with it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so first of all, you know, trying to get rid of that idea of the achievement mentality and to really, you know, be focused on the notion that Krishna's grace is, you know, it's there. It's always there. And then now I'm looking more to see where does my resistance. You know, so instead of trying to, you know, do this and this and this to get the, you know, to deserve the next sealed love of mercy, no, it's already there. But obviously, I'm resisting. So where is my resistance?
Mm.
And where can I begin to trust Krishna more? For me, like surrender means you kind of let go of things you don't need anymore, because we've acquired so many things that let's get through this disconnected world that we're in. And so when we feel connected with Krishna, we can let go of things. It's a kind of a sweet surrender. Mm-hmm. And I can feel comfortable with that enough that I'm assured enough of Krishna's love. And then as much as possible, you know, I'm trying to be somebody who can listen to people without judgment and you know, try to connect with them that way to build my relationships with people better. I guess that's a huge thing too. Mm-hmm. Try to do a better job with that. And I guess that's really kind of that sort of thing, trying to understand more and more where the old paradigm still remains.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it runs deep, and so and that's probably some of the places where there's resistance. And so I'm really trying to stay with that, you know, that you know, I'm loved unconditionally by Krishna, and I want to receive that, and I want to find out where I'm resisting and where I'm still under the thrall of the old paradigm.
Mm. Sounds like a good rebuting system. Thanks for sharing with us. So in concluding, Giri Govardhan Prabhu, I like to, for a few episodes already, I've kind of inaugurated a closing section to most of my podcasts. In our Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, we have this saying, Madhurena Samapayet, like end with something sweet, whether when we are eating or speaking, but also I've kind of adjusted that to something that in Sanskrit could be called Ushnena Samapayet, with ending with something hot or spicy. So I will present to you, if you agree with me, a series of brief hot questions, and don't be afraid, they won't be that hot. It's just like short questions, honest answers, no overthinking. Basically, that's the premise.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
In connection to what we were talking so far, of course.
Okay.
Okay, number one, it will be a series of 10 very brief. Which is the anartha that you are most grateful to have recognized?
I think the idea of that I'm wanting credit for my spiritual life, I think that's probably the one that was part of my self-esteem.
Okay, thank you. What's that stage that you would like to raise? Not stage, but what's a phrase that you would like to raise from devotional culture forever?
Anything that's related to, you know, to earning and deserving. You know, there's somebody that, like, you know, somehow I'm going to qualify myself, become qualified, or become these kinds of things that really, really imply the earning and deserving. There's a lot of language like that.
Good. And that reminds me about one line from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, a thing from his Navadvipava Taranga. He will speak about adhikar, sometimes translated as qualification. He said, our adhikar comes from Krishna's mercy. In other words, the more Krishna grace from God we have, the more we augment our qualifications. So we are qualified by grace. So anyhow.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That fits perfectly. Yeah.
What's the most liberating spiritual insight of the last decade in your life?
That's the one that right now in my broken state, you know, Krishna comes to us and he offers himself. You know, the holy name is himself, and that's his first move. I wasn't even looking for it. And he says, hi, here I am, take me. And, you know, he already gives everything. He gives everything in the first moment. And it's just my resistance that doesn't allow me to accept it.
Thank you. What's a devotional practice that has helped you, especially help you in the dark?
You know, I started at some point to do just quiet meditation, to see what would come up. You know, because when you're dealing with a persona, an external persona, and you're kind of suppressing your internal self, you're not aware. There's so many things that are right there under the surface that you're not aware of. And so I started at some point. I'm doing it a little bit less now because I think I'm more in tune. But it really helped me to just to be quiet and see what's coming up for me.
Great. I also do that just in case, by the way. Very important.
Yeah.
What's the most distorted idea of success in bhakti?
I think wanting authority over others instead of, you know, like the whole notion of being advanced means you become an authority and you exercise control over others. When actually the more that you have to offer, the more obligation you have to help others. Actually, Bhakti Tirtha Swami put it this really sweetly. Basically, he said that it's a privilege to help others. And so sometimes we think that if we become, you know, so advanced then we can, you know, we take away, we interfere with other people's agency, and we impose things upon them. Instead, we're supposed to, you know, be supportive in helping them. And so that kind of a notion of becoming an authority.
Thank you. I recall with Richard Rohr, in this case, speaking, an authority is someone who has been authored by life and God's grace. Only then you can be an authority. You have to be authored, written by life and God's grace. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a book that shook your spiritual framework in the best way? I know that you may have.
How about that one where Richard Rohr gave that quote about, you know, God's grace being, you know, by being who he is. That was the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus's alternative plan.
That's the name of the book.
Yeah, the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus, and that really did something. There was other ones. There was this one called The Language of Emotions by Carla McLaren, which was something that was quite interesting.
Okay. Thank you for those suggestions. I'm sure the audience is taking note of them. A few more. Which is one truth you wish you had heard earlier on the path?
Yeah, I guess that's the same one, you know.
Yeah, no problem. You can repeat yourself all the time.
The same one that we're accepted. You know that God is only love. That God, and what, people say God is love, you know, but sometimes we don't understand that carefully. But that that's what He is. That's why He exists as He does, is to love, and that's all He can do. And He's here. He comes here for us.
What's one thing you now know is not a sign of spiritual advancement?
You know, I really think sometimes we walk around in a especially in our youthful state, in kind of a spiritual bubble. And I think that we have to become, as my guru Raj would say this, he said that first we join the spiritual movement. We become pure devotees, and if we become really advanced, we become real human beings. He says it a little tongue-in-cheek, and so that really to be a real human being is so sometimes we try to put on too many airs and walk around in some kind of transcendental bubble, but we have to be able to exist in the world properly.
Yeah, as the saying says, right? We are not human beings trying to be spiritual. We are spiritual beings trying to be human.
Yes.
Yeah, two more, and I leave you free. One devotional cliche that hides a deeper truth if you sit with it. Which one will be?
Well, I really think the humility thing is one of them, because it's such a different notion. It's not feeling bad about yourself. Though, to me, it's like you said it in DC when I was at your one class. You talked about when something is too much, when somebody gives you too much, you have to respond to it. And so Krishna actually gives us too much, and so that humbles us. We feel small in comparison to what we're receiving from Krishna, but it's a beautiful feeling. It's a beautiful, joyful, wonderful smallness. Because when somebody gives you something that's too much, you feel great about it. You don't feel bad about yourself, but you feel, how can I reciprocate that? And I know I have it, but I can't deserve it. So there's no low self esteem and there's no pride. So I see humility in that way. It's a sweet smallness.
Sweet smallness. That's great. Reminds me of one line of one song from George Harrison. He will say, "It's all too much."
Yes,
in this connection.
Yeah, actually, right. Yeah, my friend Eric. He said that when I told him, you said that it was too much. He thought of that song. He said, "I don't know where he got that from."
It's all too much. It's come from there. And the last question, Gir Gauranga Prabhu, if you have 10 seconds to whisper something to your younger devotee self, what will it be?
Yeah, I mean that to relax, you're accepted, and be patient, and don't become bigger, become smaller, in a sweet way.
Thank you. I'm sure we all are whispering, taking from your words inspiration, and whispering something similar to our own younger devoted self. So thank you so much for sharing. And to conclude, if someone is quietly wondering, probably you will say something similar to your last whispering you share. Someone is quietly wondering now, maybe I'm failing spiritually, I'm in a plateau, I'm stagnant, I've reached again another plateau, I thought I was in one, I progress, I'm in another one. What gentle truth you would like to offer them to conclude today, something they can carry with them into this chapter of their journey?
That Krishna never gives up on you. He never gives up. And so there's no need for you to give up. So that's what we're thinking. We're so bad, therefore, Krishna's going to be upset with us, or he's going to finally lose patience with us. And it's never happening that way. And so don't feel shame. Brené Brown, she makes that distinction between, she says, guilt and shame. And guilt is when you feel you've acted in the wrong way. And she says, actually can be healthy. Then you want to, but shame means that you feel that you are incapable of acting in any other way. It disempowers you. You are bad.
But maybe done something that's not good. I am bad. Yeah.
I am bad, which then destroys you. So please, Krishna doesn't give up on you. Everything you've done has been done so many times before by so many. You're not unusual in any case. There was the there was a funny quote that they say about, you know, Srila Prabhupada, when some devotee was saying that they were the most fallen, and Prabhupada said, you're not the most anything. And so, you know, kind of, but anyway, but, you know, but it's not, you know, what we're going through is, it's been, it is being gone through by so many others. It has been gone through by people who have, you know, passed further on. There's no reason for you to be discouraged with yourself. There really isn't. It's, everything is going to be fine.
Thank you. Thank you for giving us that piece of wisdom and that big piece of hope that we all needed in our journey. It has been my honor and great pleasure to have you here today in this conversation, Giri Govardhan Prabhu, and looking forward to continue sharing and developing our relationship so we can walk our talk, literally what we have been talking today here. So thank you so much.
I'm really, really happy that we made the connection. It's beautiful. Your virtual association also has been very, very helpful to me. So I'm
but looking forward to our next 3D meeting.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.